Good morning. For those of you who don't know me, my name is John Coffey, and I'm with the MSU Libraries. And I'm glad to welcome you here to the latest presentation in the University Libraries Colloquia series. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. David Solomon. Dr. Solomon is faculty in the Office of Medical Education, Research, and Development here at Michigan State, and he's been very instrumental in recruiting our esteemed guest speaker today. Dr. Solomon?
Thank you, John. First, I want to thank the library for hosting this, and John particularly for organizing the talk. I also like to thank the College of Education, who actually brought Dr. Lewinsky here for us on another talk, and allowing us to borrow him for a day to talk about electronic publication. Dr. Lewinsky is currently the Pacific Coast Professor of Literacy and Technology at the University of British Columbia, and he's published numerous books and articles on a whole variety of fields, including electronic publication and the dissemination of knowledge. He recently won the American Educational Research Association's award for the outstanding book for his book, Learning to Divide the World. And he's published several books on disseminating information, and is currently nominated for the Best Article Award for the AERA Special Interest Group on Communication Among Researchers, which I'm leading at the moment. And it's a real pleasure to have Dr. Lewinsky.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you, John. It's a pleasure for me to be here speaking to librarians. I've been working on this project for only about 3 or 4 years. I'm still new at the idea of changing the entire world of publishing and for scholarship and for public knowledge generally. So I'm still at that naive, innocent, romantic stage, and I'm hoping you won't spoil it for me, but I am hoping that you'll give me some perspectives in terms of the librarian's position. It was about 6 or 8 months ago that I realized and I know I was late coming to this, but that the library was the linchpin in terms of any kind of change in scholarly publishing. And largely around the issue of budget and the budgetary crisis in scholarly publishing, but also around the whole sense of how the library is changing and how the library, in some ways, is at risk with the new virtual cyberspace, with the new sense that the library is no longer at the center of knowledge, that it's somehow out there in the Ethernet. But also in the sense that librarians are changing in terms of their attitudes, education, and sensibility. I'm hoping all that is true. What I want to do today is to talk to you about a model that I've been developing called the knowledge exchange model. It's one potential way to go with electronic publishing. What it's really about is the position of the library on one level, and in terms of scholarly publishing. On the other side, it's about the whole public access question in terms of technology. What I want to do is take you through some of the issues that I think are pertinent. I'm coming to you as a social scientist, and in fact, this work started really with my concern, not just with my own work failing to have the great impact I imagined it would have, but generally, my colleagues, too, were feeling the same kind of doldrums that how is it that we do so much important, critical work that we think of as a public good, and it's just not being taken up to the degree that we might have hoped in areas of policy, in areas of practice, in the professions, and even in educational settings like this university. So the concern I had was that we are busily engaged and have been in social sciences for about a century of creating a massive body of knowledge. All of it has been declared to be in the public good and for public benefit. We've reached a critical mass, I'm sure, some time ago, but there is a sense that it hasn't been received well. It hasn't been taken up. And a good example of that is the way that the social sciences hit the news. The most recent breakthrough last week was a front page article in the New York Times, for those of you in interested in id psychology, about mice, whether the mice dream or not. Did anyone catch that article last week? So the whole question of whether mice dream kind of made the front page, and I thought, God, I'm proud to be a social scientist. We are really on the cutting edge. And finally, our contribution is being noted. And you could just see the whole, you could barely turn the page because the tongue was so firmly stuck in the cheek of the New York Times reporter interviewing the researcher And it was very difficult for the researcher to say, but seriously, there are important issues about memory and brain cognition, brain function in this question. But you know, the reporter kept asking, what about nightmares and all these kind of issues for mice, therapy and regret analysis and all sorts of aspects of it. So my concern is that the social sciences and the university in general sometimes has this kind of odd, wacky scientist approach to the media. So what I want to do today then is take you from both the scholarly rigorous questions. In fact, what I want to do is consider a model that improves the scholarly quality of what we do on the one hand and the public quality of what we do on the other hand. And I want to start, again, I've never really spoken to such a large group of librarians before. I'm not that that's intimidating. I mean, librarians are our friends. But I've, in giving talks on this issue, I've mainly spoken to social scientists. So I always have to start with these figures. And if you know these are the figures of the scholarly crisis. Because one of the starting points I don't think the rest of the faculty in the university appreciate is exactly how extensive. Certainly was a shock to me. I'd heard the phrase, the crisis in scholarly publishing. For a decade, two decades, I should look up the OED, it's probably a phrase in there, and its first dating is maybe 1959. So the scholarly, and we all know that a crisis loses some of its impact as it's repeated. In fact, it's almost in quotation marks or hyphenated, the scholarly crisis, the crisis in scholarly publishing. But just to review the facts, the ARL, the Association of Research Libraries facts, are we all librarians here? Is there a non-librarian in the house? Oh, okay, all right, for those of you who... And maybe some of you will correct my facts, but the percentage increase, let's just take the crisis in scholarly publishing is about the increase largely in medical and science and technology journals, increase in subscription prices, and from 1986 to 97, the increase is 207%. Now that doesn't mean a whole lot until you consider health. Now we all know that health costs have greatly increased in this over the last little while. Journals have increased at two times the rate, twice the rate of health costs. So it's well above inflation. It's well above some of the benchmarks for inflationary increases. But the other side of it for me, in terms of these figures, is that this is a knowledge economy. This is the age of information, and where are the libraries, the university research libraries, in the age of information? They are down 6%, it's like NASDAQ. They're down 6% in their acquisition of serials. That is, the library is decreasing its hold in an age of information, a very discouraging aspect for me in working in the library. Then we come to Reed Elsevier, if there was ever a corporate target. And again, I'm all new to this, and you can all smile and chuckle because you've known this forever. And we have Microsoft on the one hand, but Reed Elsevier has been a very discouraging experience for me in terms of the extent of this corporate hold. Its hold in science, technology, and medicine is about 30% of the market. It's not as good as Microsoft. But that is, in publishing, that's a very large share. Its rate of return, and this is the figure that's critical for me, because I do want to talk about an economy, a change in the economy. Its rate of return, as it puts it very nicely, its profit figure last year was 29% on its scholarly publishing, Elsevier, which is the main scientific side of Reed Elsevier, this conglomerate. So that's 29%. That, to me, is excess money. That, to me, is profit that's not going into, and I'll give you some of the other figures, that's not going into improving the quality of these journals. That's excess. And to me, that's money that we should take back. Okay, 30% of what looks like about a $6 billion industry worldwide. But I have another way of looking at that figure as well. The other thing is the rate at which it's growing. Now, if you imagine that the corporate control or the corporate, that was maybe overstating it a bit, the corporate interest in scholarly publishing really just started since the Second World War. Before that, it was left up to the associations. There was very little corporate involvement. I'm sure Springer Verlag and a few other companies had journals back in that period. But now there's a kind of ravenousness to the corporate interest. And this year, last year, year 2000, Reed Elsevier acquired 450 journals. Okay? Presumably from professional associations. And part of what my team is investigating is what is the carrot here? How is it that they're getting, $5,000 in photocopying? What kind of privileges are they gaining by going? So they launched 26 new journals. So the real danger here is not the inflation in information, as we're sometimes told. It's the corporate takeover. And those 450 journals have now a 29% margin, profit margin, to maintain that they didn't have to maintain in their previous existence. Well, Reed Elsevier has responded. And if I do nothing else, if we do nothing else, then shake up Reed Elsevier a bit. It's promised, if you go onto its website right now, it has a new pricing policy. It promises not to exceed, in the next coming years, 10% increases. Now, the nerve, when we're running an inflation rate of 2, maybe 3 at the worst percent, to say that we will not exceed 3 times the inflation rate in other industries. We have a 30%, 29% margin, where those of you who know the publishing industry, 3 to 4%. It would be Random House, well, perhaps not anymore with Bertelsmann, but was the traditional figure in the publishing world. The other thing that Reed Elsevier is doing is it is going electronic, and it has begun to respond to the kinds of concerns that many of us have. They're looking at preprints. They have very good, and I don't question it at all, very good electronic library access service that allows you into all of their journals. They're currently investing $60 million. This is the part that interests me in this economy. They're investing $60 million to going online with all of their journals. I mean, they seem to be all online right now as it is, but at any rate, they're further investing in it. And it is a somewhat clumsy system. I don't know if those of you who've been into it, it's not the neatest or most efficient system. But the idea that they have $60 million to invest, and where does that $60 million come from? Not all of it from MSU's library, but a good portion. I know it's one of the great libraries in the United States, but a great I mean, all of that money is obviously coming from the libraries. And the idea that we are paying at a corporate level 30% profit on everything we give to Reed Elsevier, if I can be so crass as to put it that way, that they are investing in systems that I think we could invest in and we could create, is part of the motivation for me. Because the serials budget for ARL, this is the Association of Research Libraries, which is the top 122 research libraries in North America. UBC is part of that team, where I come from, University of British Columbia, as well as MSU. The budget, and I've seen a number of figures on this, but the safest figure for me seems to be about $450 million. And that's going to be my figure, okay? The research libraries, the top 122 research libraries in the United States and Canada, are spending $450 million on serials right now. Now, in my simple-minded way, I say, that's my budget. That's the money. I have to build a system. I have to design a system that has a budget of $450 million a year in order to compete with the commercial publishers, in order to provide a substitute system. And I think it's enough to do that, an alternative system. And I think it's a handsome figure because in terms of my research grants, it's way over the top of anything I've ever had before. And I have a group of graduate students that are very excited about this project and about this prospect. And so what I'm setting out is I'm saying that, in fact, we have to work with a fixed budget. My librarian, Catherine Quinlan at UBC, when I tell her that I can reduce the cost of things by designing a system like this, getting it implemented, I know, is a small problem we'll talk about later. She says that in fact, I don't have to reduce to make her happy as a chief librarian. I have to contain. If there could be some containment of the serial budget, if there could be some predictability that is something more respectable than saying we won't exceed 10% a year for the rest of your life, then she would be happy. So I've built and think about the system as fixed. The information is not free. It may want to be free. I have trouble communicating with it. But apparently there are a group that thinks information wants to be free. That raises ontological problems for me. But it isn't free. It is expensive, and it needs to be, as it were, it's the money that it takes to use and to disseminate and create information needs to be carefully controlled, but it is containable. And if we think about the fact that we have a budget, for example, in the research libraries of $450 million, then we need to work with those figures. And that $450 million does need to contribute to editing and copy editing and proofreading. It needs to contribute to dissemination. It needs to contribute to professional associations that have sponsored the editors and the organization of the journals. But I think there is enough money in the system at this point to build an alternative way of going about it. So I'm about free access, but not about information that wants to be free. Now, that's the one point. That's the crisis in scholarly publishing. You all know it very well. You can see why it's an inspiring point for some people. It's interesting, when I've spoken to people about this, there comes a point where they say economics isn't the question. They don't say stupid at the end of that, gladly. That there is a limit to the persuasiveness. And part of my challenge in this whole project has been finding a rhetoric, finding an art of persuasion. And at first, when I read these figures over, and although I'd heard about it for years, when I finally went into the figures about 8 months ago, I thought, this is it. who can say no to these figures? But people say we've been living with this forever, and that's not going to be the tipping point. And the idea of what is the tipping point in terms of getting people to change is an interesting challenge for me. And I want to go through a number of those aspects with you. The knowledge economy is, I've already touched on that for a moment. The research library and the whole university's position in the knowledge economy, I think, has to be taken more seriously. There's a sense in which the university has been or is being marginalized in this knowledge economy. That sense in which the university had a monopoly, as it were, on knowledge production for a very long time, for let's say a century and a half or two centuries in terms of the, really a century for the research university. But the idea that the knowledge economy exists outside of the university, and that the knowledge economy is about something other than the public good of knowledge is what concerns me. And that the age of information and what's driving it has, as it were, presents a whole series of challenges. And this morning we were talking, David and I, about PubMed and the challenges around medical information and how the proposals to open that system further were brought to an end, or essentially brought to an end, by the corporate control of publishing that weren't willing to cooperate and share the information that they had, that we had given them for free, but we'll get into that part. The examples in the knowledge economy, and usually, typically, I look at areas like Napster and the Oxford English Dictionary. I'm a big fan of the Oxford English Dictionary, and some of you know, I mean, we should all just bow our heads for a moment. There will be no further, as far as I can tell, printed editions of the OED. Last year, as many of you know, and someone asked me about whether MSU has bought the subscribes to the online version. Well, here, let me, where's my wallet? It's the least I can do is the OED has gone online. There were online, the UBC, the crazy part at UBC is we have an online version of the OED. It's one of the early ones. It's a very primitive, very crude one that comes up unattractively on the screen and kind of almost, you know, dot matrix. And that's hard to do on the screen, too. It's a very simple version. But they bought us, but this is what OED, but the Oxford University Press had us buy into this 10-year licensing deal for the whole, so now we can't get the new version, and we have to stay with the dot matrix on your screen version. But they did a beautiful job. The new OED, if you go to the word of the day, if you go to Oxford University Press in the dictionary section, you can see it on word of the day. They only let you have one word each day. But that's a good way to build your vocabulary. I can use a euphemism for that. That's the word of the day for today. But the OED has as it were, gone online. It's available worldwide now. And it's gone online on a subscription basis. And part of my concern is that it's now $700 probably American dollars, which means it's $900 or $1,000 Canadian, to have access to a year's subscription to the OED, which is kind of a perverse, what? Oh, for the whole lot, yes, I meant individual subscriptions. Oh, for private individuals, yes. No, right, oh, I'm sure it's much more for the library. And they do have, and I appreciate this, they do have, as it were, a third world policy for access. But again, there's something just pitiful about the empire striking back by selling the OED back to, third world, as it were, developing countries at a slightly reduced rate. The whole thing just I find appalling, because the other aspect that the OED does, and those of you who know the history of the OED, and I have a book available, I hope, at the bookstore for you on that, called The Reign of, The Empire of Words, is that it was a public project. The OED in the 19th century was the great Victorian research project in which the universities had very little, Oxford and Cambridge, which were, had very little involvement. In fact, the University Press, Oxford University Press, really took it over because Bible sales were falling off. There was a saturation of the market, and they saw the dictionary as the, and they were very prophetic prescient in seeing that the dictionary would be their future in terms of the secularization of them. Let's not get into that part of it. That's why they had that excess paper, you know, that thin paper the dictionaries printed on. It was all left over from the Bible printing, but I don't want to take you down that road right now. It was a public project, and the public contributed, and James Murray, a school teacher, and I am a former school teacher, assembled, as it were, an army, a very balanced gendered army, to assemble the language. The OED is now going through its first thorough revision. Okay, that was part of the announcement. There was a partial revision. If you buy the OED now, it's a paste together. You have words in the OED right now that have not been changed since the Victorian era, and words that have been changed, as it were, in the edition of the 70s and 80s. So the first edition, so they announce this public project on the one hand, but as part of this knowledge economy, they in fact close access at this subscription rate that I think is prohibitive for participation in the project itself, where they had a wonderful opportunity to open the dictionary, probably still sell the kinds of value-added subscriptions to libraries, but they didn't go that route. All right? And you can look at the Britannica, and you can look at other areas that have this kind of middle ground between public access. The Britannica is a good example of going the other way. It's now free and available in every computer port, every internet access point. It has advertising at the top and the bottom of the page, and in the middle if the column's kind of thin. But it took a different road. And those kinds of questions to me are very interesting. They're very interesting for the nature of the library, because the Britannica in the library now doesn't have the same significance as it would have in the public library, that is. Those have to be considered. The Napster example, in terms of the knowledge economy, is an interesting one because of the distribution system. I know Napster is probably not do we have permission to use Napster? Some campuses now forbid the use of Napster. Oh, I have medical release to use Napster because I'm doing research in this area. I don't have medical release to use marijuana, but I have medical release to use to sample Napster because I'm doing research in distributed systems. And Napster's ability to mobilize 32 million people to exchange and allow their computers to be used as web servers, if you wish, or information servers, is an interesting phenomenon for me. The kind of participation rate. They're being sued, of course, by Bertelsmann and other companies who are also investing in Napster at this point, and it's creating all kinds of strange anomalies. I'm only suggesting that we need to participate. The library and the university needs to participate in this economy and needs to cut some new ground in this economy, and that what Britannica, OED, Napster are all doing is cutting new paths in this accountability, in this economy. The next point is accountability. The third point in terms of finding a point of persuasion around this model, and I haven't presented the model to you first, I want to persuade you first. I mean, in some ways I feel like I'm talking to the converted in terms of librarians, but it's a good practice for me, okay? Indulge me, please. But I'm also very interested in librarians' perspective on this, because it does fall obviously on your shoulders to some degree. The accountability question for me, particularly in the social sciences, is the whole sense of the public presence of social science and other forms of research. The research library has always been, in communities, a center of knowledge. And there's always been, and certainly at MSU and other places, open stacks, open access. If you can pay for the parking, this is MSU. If you can find the parking, you're welcome to use all of the research resources. I presume that's true here at the library. And that sense of that was one level of accountability. But that's a level of accountability that has existed comfortably for a century. In fact, it probably was more comfortable 50 or 60 years ago when parking was a little easier here. But it no longer fits in terms of the current state, that we need to think about how the library serves within the larger community, within this community access. And we have the possibility now of providing the kinds of resources that a research library provides to every community library, to every community organization, to every school. And the exciting part for me is the accountability of the library. And I'm very curious about MSU and the University of Michigan from a distance, the two of you competing all the time, you having the state capitol right next door, the ear of the state capitol possibly, and the whole sense of how the accountability of the university has come under increasing pressure, whether it's NEH or any other aspect of the funding of the university research programs, how we could do a great deal more to contribute to the whole sense of public discourse and public space to, as it were, defend and define a public space within a knowledge economy. Because the knowledge economy has been very much about the privatization of knowledge. And the idea that the university would be a bastion of the public form of knowledge, or the public space for knowledge, or public discourse, is a given, is something I think we take far too much for granted. And what I'm proposing is that any alternative model for scholarly publishing has to take into account the public presence of research, not just on the front page of the New York Times when someone finds out that mice are dreaming, but on a basis in which allows people to explore issues, to understand and pursue their hobbies, their interests, their personal needs, their professional interests on a more systematic basis. And that information is becoming widely available on the web through in finance, in sports, in a number of other areas, in consumer products. It's not becoming widely available and in health it is, and I'll deal with that in a moment. It's not becoming widely available in terms of the research knowledge that the universities are largely responsible for. So Given those circumstances, I want to look at some of the systems before I and I'm building up the suspense here. You're really getting curious about what does your model look like? Will I unveil it? Why is it using such primitive technology? Why isn't it using the computer? All of those questions will be answered in a moment or two. But let me be fair to my competitors and to the alternative models that are available at this point. The health and my interest in working with David in terms of his group at AERA is the whole area of medical education and medical health. The revolution, and again, this will be old hat for many of you, but the information revolution in terms of knowledge has been in health. And for me, this has great political ramifications, because my secret deep interest is in democracy, and in fact, deliberative forms of democracy. And one of the great undemocratic relationships in our lives is the doctor-patient relationship. One of the points of power, it doesn't matter how many degrees you have after your name, it doesn't matter where you how you exist in the world, the doctor-patient relationship has always been, for me, an uncomfortable assertion of power in an let's vote on that, sir. No, none of that goes on, or ma'am. It hasn't been that kind of source. And what has changed in the last 5 years is the doctor-patient relationship because of health information. The doctors are complaining. I scheduled 15 minutes for this physical examination. I spent 14 of them explaining to the patient that the web pages they brought were not appropriate and that the web pages that they had downloaded on their particular condition were controversial. And I'm saying as an educator, yes. I'm saying as an educator, that was a learning experience, and we don't have learning experiences in doctor-patient relationships as a rule, and I am all in favor for patients bringing in accurate, inaccurate, focused, unfocused information as a basis of discussion. I'm also very interested that the National Library of Medicine had to revamp its entire effort to put online medical, biomedical information because of the public response. That over the last 10 years, they were building increasing online systems to serve physicians and mainly researchers and clinicians and physicians as part of their service. And they were stunned, at least my reading of it was, they were stunned. I don't know if the National Library of Medicine gets stunned. But at any rate, let's imagine that they were stunned by the public response. And they had to redesign the system, create a system called Medline Plus that ties into PubMed, but that provides public access. It provides public access in a way, though, that does not cut the public off from the research. So if you go into Medline Plus, you can see a layperson's description of a disease. You can see a list of hospitals and doctors and physicians that are recommended for the disease. But you can also say, show me the current research. And it goes into PubMed, and it gives you the abstracts. Because they found that patients were reading the most, well, for me, medical research is one of the areas of some challenge in terms of the things we would think people couldn't read, in terms of the vocabulary level, in terms of the syntax, in terms of the intelligibility of the text, please. But that it challenged for me as an educator the whole sense of what's appropriate for public consumption, this interest. Now, I realize that health is a very urgent issue for people. I realize that research and education isn't quite as urgent. But I say quite as urgent because the education of people's children is an urgent issue for people. And I think there is an aspect in which other areas of justice, education, social welfare, labor, work, all of the areas of the social sciences at least, and then you go from the social sciences into the humanities, and you can see that the public interest in these fields might be just as great. And in fact, I would argue that social sciences can be obscure, but medical research, please, don't talk to me about the obscurity of social science research against it. So that idea that there is a public interest, that we haven't begun to tap that public interest is part of the accountability, is for me part of the responsibility of the university, that we could do a much better job of serving a much wider community than just pay tuition to us. And we could do a much better job of arguing for support in state legislatures and federally on the basis of that public uptake of our research. I have a couple of other examples to look at how the change is already taking place. I was going to look at Stephen King, but he's taken his story off the web. It didn't work. He was disappointed because the first, the serialization of one of his novels on the web. The first installment or two was taken up by 450,000 people, and that fell off after a few installments. I look at my circulation rates for my work, I found that offensive. That he felt that anything less than 450,000 readers just wasn't worth his time. He had an amazing level. About 70 or 80% of the people contributed voluntarily. to pay for his cause. He worked without a publisher. Okay, that was the real experiment. And he found that he could publish directly. And he risked being ripped off, you know, grandly. It was a free download. 80% of the people paid him a dollar, I think it was, for each installment. The whole thing was one of those interesting experiments that I think, as librarians and as people concerned with research, we need to track. And we need, as I said before, to participate in that kind of experimentation. The success story, and I've got one that just, I got an email last night about two journals that have just gone the way of free access. But the one I have to mention is the Physics Archive. It's the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Paul Ginsberg's. We all know the XXX Archive. It's the Physics Preprint Archive. It now has, it's a self-archiving system. Now, this could be scary. And it's totally unacceptable in the social sciences for reasons I'll explain in a moment. But the idea that with this archive, you can submit an article yourself, whether you're a physicist or not a physicist, whether you're in high energy particle physics or it's in mathematics now, it's in computer science, and a few areas in computer science, and a few areas in mathematics, not all of them. And it's a preprint service, and it has taken off. And Ginsberg has been running this now for about 8 or 9 years, and he has about 100,000 articles. He's getting about 100,000 hits a day. And I don't know how many worldwide physicists there are a day. How many physicists there are on a global basis? But that seems like a lot. That seems like a very high percentage of physicists are going to this. The articles have a series of metadata on them that allow you to identify whether it's been published or not. But that's not an issue. In fact, what's amazing to me is when you go into the Physics Archive, you'll see that an article will be published in Physics Letters 2 years from now, and we will get the library to buy it. Physical Letters or Physics Letters, I've forgotten the name of the title, the journal, exactly. And that to me is just money. What's that about? In 2 years, that article will have been cited 100 times, it will have been hit. Nobody is going to go into the library and take that physical hard copy of that journal. And that the kind of redundancy that the system is building in. Now, it's true that physics has its own culture. It's true that preprints, and I've spoken to people who use the system, and young scholars, and they say it's both a pleasure and a duty to go in there and find junk and identify it as junk. That in the morning, instead of doing crossword puzzles when they want to take a break, apparently they go into the XXX and find articles that have wonky titles and put the tag on them that says, you know, this is just nonsense. There's a whole system of how articles are withdrawn, articles are tagged as nonsense. They've found an alternative publishing system, and they haven't done a thing about the publishing industry. They still like to see their articles come out in print. And so this is an amazingly fun, interesting example, and for me, not a totally irresponsible one, but one that I think is missing a larger point, one that I think is irresponsible in terms of the library. Because it would seem to me that physics could organize itself around, as some journals have, some editors have done, of walking away from the commercial hard copy publication of articles. They're talking now, Open Archives Initiative is talking about overlaying a review system on top of the preprint system. My concern with that is that Open Archives, which is the largest initiative in building open access for electronic journals, is still working from the base around Ginsberg, around preprint services, and it's been made very clear to them that preprint, that is unrefereed work, is not acceptable to any degree in the social sciences or humanities and in a number of the sciences as well. And so the system that they're beginning to build isn't going to be as compatible. And one of the key points for me is we need to identify what is movable in the system and what isn't movable in the system. And for me, the peer review process and people's investment of and sense, and I have to smile because we all know the peer review process is not 100% perfect. We have to know that peer review process sometimes slips up, but at any rate, we want to identify those aspects that can change. So my fixed budget notion, and that is that we have $450 million among the ARL libraries alone, is a fixed budget system around the ego aspects. Around the security aspects. And that is, I only want to touch the parts and change the parts that I think are easily changeable. And I want to leave the rest of the security blankets, if I can put it that way with you, the rest of the things that reassure people in terms of, I want to come back to the scholarly quality thing, the rest of the system in place. Yesterday, I just got a message from Spark. And Spark is one of the ARL organizations, two journals. This is the brand new, just to keep you up to date, show you I'm right on top of these things. Algebraic and Geometric Topology. Oh, you're all not, you know this journal. You're all big readers of that one. And Documenta Mathematica. I was worried it would be in Latin, but apparently it's not. Two journals, they have both now declared themselves to be free. They are sponsored by their universities, and this is the key factor for me. Sponsored by the universities. Apparently, Algebraic and Geometric Topology is competing against a $2,500 journal. Its editors, one of its principal editors, walked away from the journal using one of those create change letters. ARL has these little form letters because they figure professors couldn't create their own letters that says, I'm walking away from this journal because the inflationary rate of your cereal prices is too much. The sense in which the libraries themselves or the universities themselves can begin to sponsor these processes is a critical factor for me and is the basis of this model. What I'm proposing is that the library take on a new function. What I'm proposing is that the library become the center of not only the organization of knowledge after it's published, but the organization of knowledge from before it's published until it's published and its continuing archiving and dissemination. Because it seems to me, in fact, there is not a school of library science at this university, but the school of library science at that other university, to remain nameless, across the road from Shame and Drum, the other university has recently gone through a controversial name change in which information science has become one of the principal elements. And if we are now treating the librarian and training and educating the librarian around concepts of information science, I think the librarian should be at the forefront from the moment a scholar thinks about where their article should be placed in terms of its publication, right through to the archiving and protecting and authenticating of the research at the end of the process. And the sense in which the library is in a position to do that is based on this budgetary figure. How much money does the library have to start publishing journals? Well, it has exactly, the average ARL library has exactly $5 million a year to do that, because that's its serial budget. Not that much? No, exactly, including indexing. Right. No, and I don't want the whole of that money. I only want a portion. Okay, the first year. I appreciate what I'm working against then are existing costs. If the Algebraic and Geometric Topology replaces a $2,500 journal, that means every library has $2,500 it does not need to dedicate to that journal. So the maximum would be $5 million. We will not get to that figure in our lifetimes. But we can see that we have resources available. What we also can see is that the publishing process itself could be reduced. The US government uses the figure of a 66% reduction. If the US Federal Depository Library went entirely online, this is a total projection, and I know the US government projections may not be the most reliable projections in the universe, they predict a 66% decrease. I think that's probably unreasonable. But I would say that we can talk about a decreased cost. The basis of how this would work for me is a couple of concepts. Paul Gurman is the chief librarian head librarian at Vanderbilt University, which is a fairly innovative center in terms of technology. They just, in fact, the New York Times had an article yesterday about they have an e-lab that they've just set up for testing people's responses to websites, which doesn't seem all that innovative to me. But anyway, Gurman has been promoting a notion in Spark of the circle of gifts. And it's very close to, in fact, at the Coalition of Networked Information, Paul and I are going to do a little head-to-head presentation in Washington in April. He's calling it a circle of gifts, I'm calling a knowledge exchange. He's got me hands down in terms of his title. It's Hallmark all over me. I really like circle of gifts. When you used to do that number, you pick the numbers when you're in grade 5 and you do the circle of gifts. But the concept is that libraries have strong collections. Libraries and universities have strong areas within them. And what Paul Gurman is working on is an area that Vanderbilt is quite strong in, and that's Near Eastern Ancient Studies. And he's proposing that the Vanderbilt sponsor a whole series of resources on Near Eastern Studies as a gift, and that Harvard and MSU and the University of Michigan will return the favor. What I'm proposing with the knowledge exchange model is somewhat different. And again, I think these are rather arbitrary that need to be worked out. My proposal was the library should sponsor the publication of the research of every faculty member. That in fact, the distributed network system that we have enables us to, let me just take you through this very briefly, to publish, as it were, all of the research that's produced on this faculty. And if we have a faculty of 2,000, 2,500, each of them produces 1.8 articles on average a year. They never get finished. You know, it's at Christmas time. They get slowed down. Only get that 0.8 out. So we're not looking. When I talk to my chief technical people, they laugh at the storage space we're talking about. It's not a whole lot. But it's a very easy system to take those articles, to mount them at the library, and to have them exist on the web as if they were grouped by subject area, by author, because of distributed systems and tagging systems I'm going to speak about very briefly. But the idea then is we take the 450 million, not all of it, that the research libraries, just the top 122 research libraries currently invest in acquisition, and if we take 30% of that figure or 80% of that figure, and we say that's the money we have to mount the research in North America, then I think we can describe a system that would provide free public access, as it were, to the rest of the world, to students and professors in other parts of the world that are no longer able to afford journals. I have friends in Turkey, for example, who tell me their libraries have virtually ceased all serial acquisition and canceled all of their journals because they are too unpredictable and because the currency exchange kills them year after year after year. And Turkey is, I would consider to be kind of midpoint in a scale in terms of academic resources. Think about the rest of the world. And it seems to me that it's a very positive action that if we could build a system for distributing globally, and both publishing and distributing based on a budget like $450 million a year, that we would be doing a great turn. Now that's a fairly idealistic and a fairly naive starting point. But just think that a starting point needs to have those qualities. A starting point needs to have as much breadth in its naivete as its depth in idealism. And the idea that we could begin to think about this in terms of experiments at Vanderbilt, Gurman will be mounting the Near Eastern archives, and I can give you some examples of how that's going to work. At UBC, we're setting up a public knowledge project in which we're looking at a number of resources that we're going to be putting online on this free basis, including educational data and a journal in English education, and a few just small projects that we've done as prototypes. It will take some time, I think, for this idea to spin. Let me look at the scholarly quality and the public quality then. Let's review this economic model then. The basic economic model is we see the serial library budget to be a resource which we need to think about shifting from commercial publishing into library publishing. We need to do that in very close association with the professional associations. The model, and I'm have asked John to produce for you a six-page schematic of this whole project. We'll describe a little more about the distribution of resources. But I see the professional associations taking responsibility for the editorships, for the review process, and for the division of the field. And that is, how is the field going to be defined? What are the categories? What are the areas people can submit to? I see them working very closely with librarians and with the ARL to talk about how this knowledge should be organized. And I see the existing resources of the membership fees for the professional association, the serial acquisitions budget for the libraries to be the money that we're working with. If there are more questions about the details around this, I hope there'll be a few minutes for us to discuss the economics of it. So that's a very broad picture in terms of economic irresponsibility. Sorry? And the university presses pose a particular challenge because they fall between the commercial, they're becoming increasingly commercial and trade focused, and the university itself, the university community. But we'll come to that. Let me deal with the two, the scholarly and public quality. The scholarly quality for me is an important one in terms of my goal of improving the scholarly quality. That is, this system has to contain the costs, it has to increase the public presence, but it also has to improve the scholarly quality. And I look at a whole series of aspects of this that I'm not going to go into in detail with you. One is the review process. Can the review process, the peer review process, be improved? Yes. Can it be sped up? Yes. Can it be more systematically conducted? Yes. And can it be more equitably distributed beyond the friendship circle of the editor? Yes. Okay, that's done. We've improved it. The second problem I've run into is the ego problem. There is the economy problem and there's the ego problem. Where is the prestige? If I kill brain or sell, how do I replace the ego of the people who publish in that? How do I restore them? How do I keep them? It's a ranking system. What I've realized in publishing, it's all about ranking. What I need to be able to tell people on this new system that I'm proposing is, what are the top articles? Not only what are the top articles in a particular field, but who are the top authors? Not only who are the top authors, but what is the top school? Now, what I realized last night is what a wonderful tool for selecting graduate schools for students. Go in and tell me, what is the top school in terms of publications in a particular area? A pediatric oncology, to take an example we talked about this morning. That whole sense that, in fact, a online system that is thoroughly indexed, and I'm going to talk about indexing in one moment, provides you with a level of ranking that the journals have never been able to provide, that the citation ISI citation index hasn't been able to provide. You can feed the ego every day of these people by giving them a ranking by week, by month, by day, by citation, by reference at cocktail parties, as long as it's recorded and put on the web. You can take care of that concern about prestige in a much more direct way. Because up to now, we've had this kind of, if you get into brain or cell, you've made it. Doesn't mean your article's the best article. Now we can do it by article. Now we can do it by author, lifetime, last decade, last 5 years. If people are concerned about that aspect, we've got it covered. Okay? We can trace the influence. A rather interesting aspect is we can look at how articles travel through the literature in interesting ways. One of the new services, and Highwire, by the way, is at Stanford University Libraries. I almost said Stanford University Press. It's an organization that comes out of the Stanford University Libraries. Highwire is the, it did Oxford University Press, the electronic version. It's got about 222 journals and things like Oxford that it's put online. It has done no social sciences, but if you go there now, highwire.com, no, highwire.stanford.edu, you'll see that it's now going to go into the social sciences field. One of its features in one of its free journals, and one of the unfortunate parts for me, is that Highwire charges about $100,000 to do this for your journal, and the journals aren't getting any freer by virtue of that. But the British Medical Journal, BMJ, is one of the ones that is free. It has a future element. Not only can you look at the citations, you can ask it to email you every time the article is cited into the future. And that whole sense of how we can create a system that tracks far better, that says not only is there more information, but there are better ways of tracking and containing that information. Because one of the challenges we have as faculty is containing not the budget for the library, but containing the flow of information. And these systems, I think, promise that. Indexing is the critical factor for me. In fact, I think indexing might even be the tipping point. Because when I discovered that the library is spending about $1 million a year on indexing services that have incredible redundancy within them, that is, most journals are indexed by 4 or 5 different services. We now are buying indexing services that have full text to journals that we are also subscribing to electronically and in print. Indexing seems to me to be the low-hanging fruit. I'm learning all these new hip cyber expressions, the low-hanging fruit of this whole industry, because indexing is probably the easiest thing we could automate. Indexing is probably the easiest thing that we could create as a universal system in terms of using, I don't want to get into the technical aspects, but of metadata, Dublin Core, XML tagging. And indexing is the real weak point right now in terms of electronic publishing. And I was talking, David is an electronic publisher, and he apologized over breakfast that he wasn't yet in PubMed in the but he wasn't Eric. But the electronic journals are not being indexed. The electronic journals are falling through the cracks around that. And so we are creating these little pockets of wonderful accessibility of every issue of an individual journal, but we don't have that indexing system. So what we need to think about, and what I think librarians could help as information scientists more than anything, is the thinking through of better indexing systems. And that the library could begin to think about how it could provide indexing services for every electronic journal that is associated with MSU would be the kind of initiative that I would hope would happen in terms of this cooperation with librarians from the very moment an article is created. Because what we need with indexing is self-indexing. What we need is for faculty to begin to index their own work. And people tell me faculty cannot index their own work. My challenge to that is, and I work in the social sciences where APA, American Psychological Association, reigns. They have trained us. APA has trained us that if there are two editors of the journal and they are not in a relationship of any other than professional, then you put them in alphabetical order with their second name. We understand that there's a space and a comma and a colon and all of that bibliographic nicety. And they have trained us, and they send back our articles if we don't follow that. We can do indexing. We can say, this is who I want to read my article. This is the community I want to tap into my article. When people look for this subject, I want them to see my article. That element of ego attachment would create a lovely indexing system. Now, the indexing would have to be part of the peer review, part of the analysis, but self-indexing to me seems to be an easy one. All right, so that would improve the indexing system. So if I convinced you, at least somewhat, that we can improve the review process, that was too easy. The ranking process, there's a few challenges there, and the indexing process. That's the scholarly improvement. What about the public? Now, in terms of the public interest, I've got a couple of examples, and I'm running out of conscious of the time, and I do want to show you a couple aspects of the system itself. The public challenge for me is around everything as idealistic as deliberative democracy and the public sphere and Habermas and that whole notion of how we position the university as part of the public. It has to do with Gutenberg and the whole revolution in terms of print and democracy and the spread of print. Actually, Gutenberg's just come into question. I have to be careful I use that. Now, did you see the question about whether Gutenberg actually invented movable type? They're just these revisionist historians. I don't know what to. And anyway, the so-called Gutenberg revolution, as we now have to say, in this postmodern era, suggested a whole range of possibilities for literacy. That in fact, literacy spread. First there was the technology, and then there was the spread of literacy. And the technological spread of literacy happened over quite a long time. There was not a real spread of literacy until public literacy until the 19th century, right? Until the public schooling and the public library movement. And the kind of initiative represented by the public library movement is part of the inspiration for this project. When people talk to me about equities, about the inequity, about the have and have nots in terms of technology, I used to buy that and hang my head in shame that I was backing technology, and that's why I'm not using this machine. Until I realized that access to print is far more extensive than access to technology. That in terms of universities outside of North America and Western Europe, access to print is prohibitive. Access to technology is going to happen in a way it hasn't happened with print. Because one computer in one community provides access, even now, to about 8,000 electronic journals that wouldn't have been available by print. So when anyone raises the fact that you are interested in technology and therefore backing the have and have not, ask them about books in the home, books in libraries, books and journals in places other than North America and Western Europe, what we call the developed world. The question then for me around equity of access is that we have a responsibility to increase that. We have a responsibility to create systems that distribute the knowledge because we're really in the business. We have as an interest. We're not making money off this dissemination of knowledge. We're giving it away. And that's interesting parallel with Napster. Why is Napster in court? It's because they don't own the songs. Why aren't we building Napster? Because we own the songs as faculty, the research, forgive me. The question around the inequities is also around the public libraries. And that is, the public libraries are moving into technology, and the relationship between research libraries and public libraries, which has never been very strong, has a tremendous possibility. And so, forgive me for the Andrew Carnegie, you know, capitalist, for, you know, the whole redemption, all of that aspect, but Carnegie is still a kind of inspiration in a kind of strange way for me. And it may be the connections to Matthew Arnold, and we can get into that another time, but the Bill Gates' movement with the libraries. All of these elements, I think, need to be, as it were, exploited and looked into. Bill Gates is doing a kind of Carnegie. In fact, the parallels are very, very strong in terms of even the numbers of developing technology in the libraries. And it's obviously self-serving in a way that Carnegie's wasn't, although there was, you know, steel in the new libraries that he built. The sense in which that potential relationship between research libraries and public libraries is one that I think needs to be extended. Now, if we take that public aspect and the question about whether the research will contribute to deliberative democracy, whether it will not just feed into interest group politics, are all questions that I don't have time to work with right now. What I want to work with right now is the question of how we see research taking on a public presence. And I want to do that in a way that says that research, the problem with research, one of the principal problems with research, is not its unintelligibility. Because the medical research is my best example of that. And thank heavens it was medical research that was first taken up by the public, because it does away with the intelligibility factor, for me at least. The question is the integration. Is what Medline Plus does is it integrates concerns about issues like what hospitals and doctors, laymen or laypersons, language, and medical research, and clinical trials. The other thing Medline Plus does is it provides you access as a patient to what clinical trials are going on and what are available. And so you go into the doctor's office and you say, I'd like to participate in this trial. You know, can you imagine that? The doctor saying, well, I was thinking about that myself, and you know, I'm glad we can discuss that, and that, I know, I'm not being fair, there may be physician, yeah, I'm sorry, spouse. But at any rate, that kind of change in relationship, I think, can go on in schools, I think it can go on in welfare agencies, I think it can go on in the criminal justice system, that same sense that there is a right to this information. And I feel it so strongly that if nobody took up this information that I made public on my part, I would still feel justified. I would still say, I still have an obligation to make it public, even if no one reads my research. That's true now, it may be true in the future, but it's a risk I think I have to take, because on every research grant I have ever received, if you read the explanation, the rationale, at some point I have used that phrase, this will help, this speaks to an urgent problem, this is something that is necessary to be funded. So how do we begin to integrate this knowledge? Now, what I want to do is take you through, these are the systems that we have built. The one thing that we've done over the last year, when I say we, the Public Knowledge Project, is build a series of systems that try to integrate. What I'm suggesting is that, my handy marker. What I'm suggesting is that at any given point in which you look at a research study, you should be able to move in a number of directions. And this takes the Medline Plus model to the extreme. Obviously, you want to see related studies. And whether it's related studies by topic, author, the sample that was used, and again, I'm using the social sciences here as an example, so it might be grade 3 students, it might be welfare to work parents. The method that was used in the study, one of the interesting aspects of the indexing system that we need to explore is we need to go further with indexing. That is, we need to think about indexing studies in different ways, because as researchers, we often go into studies for different purposes. We may want to do an analysis, for example, of Q-sorts, which is a social science technique, and it's very difficult now, although it does come up in keyword searches often. But keyword searches themselves have certain limits defined by the field. The location of the study, whether the study is active or proposed. And again, that whole sense of being able to work with work that not only is published because of the lag time, but work that's still in process. But one of the problems with information online is, how do you get critical about it? How do people judge that a study's a good study? Now, you can do the ranking system. Remember my ranking system. Is this in the top? I only want to see articles that are in the top 10. Or I only want to see them from universities that are on number 1 in US News and World Reports. Education here is very good. Did you know the standing of education? Number 1 in 3 categories in education. That's very impressive. But we need to have a position in which people can see the critical discourse. What happens when you look at the bibliography of a research study, they often are missing the critical work. The work that criticizes what they're doing and what they've done in the past. I know, it's so surprising to me. We need to build a system, an indexing system, in which that happens automatically. That is, even though I don't want you to see Jones's critique of my work, if I put in the tags that identify my work, and if Jones puts in the tags that identify the same field and perhaps my name is the subject of his article, it should be available within proximity. So I can say, show me, as it were, the critiques, the commentary. Let me enter into an online discussion on the work. What we've done in this field in Vancouver is we did one with the Vancouver Sun, the newspaper in town. And I'm the Pacific Press professor, so I have a slight obligation there. I have to give a plug for the Vancouver Sun, or I can't pick up my check at the end of the month. What we did is we built a series of research site like this, in which you could go, you could read the newspaper article. Where would the newspaper article? Right here, in the media. You could read a newspaper article. You could ask yourself, are there any research studies? And we would show you the research studies about gender and technology was one of the articles we did. You could then go to the online commentary, and you could carry on an online discussion with the provincial minister of education. What a coup. We got him to participate in the online discussion. He said he was too busy. Okay, I'll do it. And then, because we have a tracking system, we tracked him. He came on every day to see if anyone had raised a question and how they had responded to his question. He didn't know we were. There was an informed consent letter on the site. But what was interesting is we had the Minister of Education, which is the highest education official in the province of British Columbia. We also had the researchers, the local provincial researchers online. Now, we didn't have the participation level. We were somewhat disappointed. One day, the newspaper gave the wrong URL on the article. That kind of cut down our activity a bit. So I'm not suggesting this was an overwhelming phenomenon, but it was a demonstration. But when you're in a research study, you also need to be able to see an overview, to get an overview of these things. And in all of our fields, we have meta-analysis, we have synthesis, we have review articles, and it would be very easy to index work so that it automatically positioned itself as an overview and to have the articles that were fall under. But the interesting possibility of the web for me is right here in this area of research materials. And that is, we now, the excuse we use in the social sciences, space does not permit me to include any counterexamples, that's what I'm trying to say. Space doesn't permit me to include any data that argues against my hypothesis. I wish it did, but I just can't include it. I can only include the data that supports my hypothesis. Well, that excuse needs to vanish because we do have the space. But the idea that there would be instruments and source documents in terms of history or other fields as an ability to drill down. What's also interesting about the inclusion of data, for example, is the expense. One of the really expensive aspects of social sciences is you always have to create new data. Actually, the United States has, as it were, national data sets that are available and are treated as like national resources, heritage sites that are protected. But most of the work in social science doesn't carry on this kind of reanalysis of data. And it would improve the quality of the work if there was reanalysis, but it would also reduce some of the costs in terms of the research itself. There are obviously the background material I've talked about in terms of the author, the history, historical work on the subject itself. These things are fairly basic. The glossary is a necessary one. But what the really exciting one for me is this kind of integration. I've talked about media. Let me give you an example for government. What we took with the provincial government once we'd established this relationship is they had a new policy they were proposing in education and technology. Fine. And for every section in the policy on technology and education, we had provided the background research. And so people could see, we had forums to discuss things with the government, and we had a place where you could give advice to the government. What we found is people carried on and gave advice to the government without consulting the research. You know, surprise, surprise. But what was more interesting for us is we had people who didn't participate in the discussion but went through and read the research. We had one teacher told us he'd read 300 of the items that we had online just out of interest. And it was that kind of surprising result. Of course, most of the teachers went online, gave their advice, and left and didn't carry on with this kind of connection. The idea then that we could connect our research into these systems, and again, it can be done automatically if you imagine this XML tagging system and the Dublin Core or some other standard that develops. You know that the US government and the Canadian government are deeply committed to putting more and more of this kind of information online. The media resources are, of course, online in different ways in terms of free access, of course. Organizations are very active in this area. But universities like MSU and others are very interested in promoting online courses. I'm just talking to a gentleman in education who's about to retire into online-dom. He sees himself on a cruise ship running courses for MSU. It's a very competitive world. But just imagine going into a research study and saying, this is fascinating. It's an area I want to pursue. It looks like MSU is a leader in this field because it came out in the top 10 repeatedly. Is MSU offering any courses, online courses in this area? Okay, and again, you can see the library is kind of managing some of those aspects. So this integration, for me, is probably the most exciting area. I can just give you a sense of what it would look like. I'd love to use this cube, this kind of exploding cube, as a metaphor online, but it doesn't really work in terms of the way we think about screens until we get that holograph projection ability. And you can see I'm a couple stages behind in that. But what it could look like online is if this is a knowledge exchange portal. And what I see this is fixed, as it were, as a general portal for the whole system. So this is now encompassing. Behind this portal is the entire world of, just bear with me for 1 second here, the entire world of academic publishing. So all of the journals now have joined the knowledge exchange model in all of the areas. So we have academic associations across the entire universe. We have mapping tools for organizing it, obviously these search engines. We have the greatest hits or top 40 by discipline, all these abilities. But this is what it would look like. If you come into a study, come into a research study, you can then ask it to show you these areas that you've now seen on the cube and now you're seeing on a list, and enable you to do the following. Now, the question about public access, in terms of do we want the public messing? Do we want the public raising questions with our research? And again, the examples, it's not for me to decide, it's for the professional associations to decide. And what I love is the physics one. High energy particle physics says anyone can submit an article. There's no control or restriction on this. You can be, I don't know how many they get for perpetual motion a month or a week, but that whole sense of public participation. Clearly, it would call for some kind of moderation or some kind of control, but it would be a very interesting aspect. Is the public really a danger? Because one of my biggest concerns is that we no longer hide behind the veil of obscurity when we talk about academic freedom. We no longer say that academic freedom depends on people's ignorance about what we do. We no longer say, my academic freedom is I don't have to explain what I do to anybody. That, for me, is the weakest version, the most objectionable version of academic freedom. What academic freedom should mean, at least for me, is that I am willing to give an account. I am willing to have people examine what I am doing. I am willing to justify my work to peers. But I am no longer prepared to simply say, I can't let the public into this stuff. It's too difficult. It's too obscure. And say, therefore, I have the right to conduct the kind of research that I want to conduct. The model, as it exists, is, and I have been accused of a slight presumption about it, and the Mussolini, Stalin kinds of comparisons I resent. But at the one end, I wanted to build through what it would be at its most extensive. At the other end, I'm working on a very small scale with the Public Knowledge Project. We have worked with the Vancouver Sun. We have worked with the Ministry of Education. We are working with ETANA, which is the Electronic Tools for Near Eastern Ancient Studies. I'm working with a group on the Georgia Basin Sustainable Development, which is an ecological group. I'm working with the province around its educational data. So I'm really looking for small-scale projects to build prototypes, to demonstrate what this would work like. I need to demonstrate three things. I need to demonstrate that it contains the cost, I need to demonstrate that it improves the scholarly quality, and I need to demonstrate that it increases the public presence of the research. And so what I'm inviting MSU and others to consider is what are the possibilities for small-scale projects. What are the abilities to help journals that are working on campus that are thinking about going electronic? What are the possibilities of conducting research, as it were, around questions of experimental indexing systems, whether it's with computer science that are doing a lot of work on digital libraries, whether it's in other areas in terms of student work and online courses, those possibilities. I'm looking to the library for leadership, for cooperation, and for collaboration. And let me just leave it at that point. Thank you very much. There was time scheduled for questions, or? Yes, sir.
How do you see the university community developing?
the corporate part is a big one, and that question about how is Reed Elsevier going to walk away from this, and shouldn't I be checking my bicycle before I get on it each day to see if it's been tampered with? There is a corporate movement this way, and my response is a couple of ways of going about that. One is that the corporate picture is always going to be partial, that we are still, that is, that they are going to design systems, and Reed Elsevier is going to design systems for its own corpus. And that's a severe limitation that we need to consider. The other element for me is that any money they put into that system is ultimately destined to come from us, that any investment is seen as is going to be recouped at a 30% gain from us. And so what I'm proposing is that we build systems that make Reed Elsevier come to us on a service basis. That is, if Reed Elsevier says, we can build that system for you, not just for our own intellectual property, but for the entire system, then I've begun to have some interest. Because the problem is, in terms of the corporate aspect, is that we are giving away our intellectual property on a value-added basis that no longer is demonstrable. The value-added aspect of commercial publishing needs to be challenged. And if Reed Elsevier or any other corporate interest can build a system that is like this and does all of this and delivers it for a containable cost, I'm happy. Well, absolutely. But can we create a public broadcasting corporation that will broadcast educational television on a basis that will compete against the networks? The answer is no. The answer is yes. That for me, PBS and NPR are examples of how systems can be challenged, as is Napster. The idea that you could create a system in which 32 people would exchange their music files when the corporate systems are doing it. But the other thing I want to say is there is still going to be opportunity for the university presses and for the commercial publishers to add value. That no matter what system we build, they're going to say, we can deliver a slightly better system for a little few dollars more. And what I'm hoping is that we will enter into agreements and arrangements with them. That is, what I envision for the system is that all of the information is free. Okay, dangerous notion. All the information is free based only on 122 research libraries. In other words, a lot of small university libraries, a lot of small community colleges are going to get free access. But if Reed Elsevier and others want to repackage this information in any form to deliver it to the desktop for continuing medical education of doctors or what other kind of enterprise they want to deliver it to, then we enter into a licensing agreement. Then we say that what's free on the web is not free for you to repackage, that we have certain intellectual obligations to the public to protect and recoup on that. So we need to think through all of these legal and elements. But the question of how is it that we're going to wrest this away, the example is just the one from yesterday, algebraic and geometric topology. If the senior editors for these journals say, I don't want to do it anymore, and evolutionary biology, does anyone know that? He's a real champion. I've forgotten his name. No, Ginsberg is the Los Alamos National Archives. Rosenberg. I think Michael Rosenberg is probably the classic example of walking away from a journal of evolutionary biology, creating his own journal, running it out of his backyard. But again, it's those one-offs are a concern to me. That if editors walk away from the major journals and create their own journal, we haven't begun to build a system. So the challenge then is to build a system, is to turn to publishers, including the university presses, for services. I mean, we may want to go back to the university, the commercial publishers for repackaging. We may want to go back to them for copy editing services. We may want to go back to them for design services. We may want to go back to them for marketing services. But we want to pay for things on a service basis, not on a turnover the intellectual property and then buy it back basis. Actually, there was one here, and then we'll go over these two.
Science
No, but I'm impressed by that aspect. Yeah, that it was 35%. No, and I think that's unfortunate because the system I would want to build would create a more equitable access, not just to the knowledge, but to participation in the knowledge, to contributions. And I don't see, I mean, the argument could be that if we're only getting 35% from North America, North America shouldn't be sponsoring or funding this. I'm not totally convinced.
I'm not making an argument you shouldn't sponsor funding.
Oh, no, but this, there is no system that isn't globally inclusive. So there isn't, in other words, the system I'm describing, based on the $500 or $450 million of the ARL, would be a globally inclusive system. And so I'm actually, I kind of slipped this part in, you didn't notice perhaps, in which I'm suggesting that the North American Library Association, first of all, it needs to become a global association and needs to include the Sorbonne or needs to include Oxford and Cambridge. But if we imagine a global, heaven forbid we have global associations in this day and age, a global association, and if we imagine that only the top research universities that are producing, and I would assume are producing a majority of the research, the top research universities, that they act as sponsoring agencies, and that people who are not in participating universities and small universities still have a right to contribute research and still have a right to access that research, even though their institution is not funding it directly. Now, again, all those points need to be worked out, whether it's a prorated scale, but the key element for me has to be everything from now on has to go global and has to be thought on a global basis. And the secularity and parochialism around our professional associations is a big concern. And it is part of the fragmentation that is frustrating the quality of our scholarship, I would argue. It was these two. I'll start here and work in. There is a role. I designed the system so there is no role for government because of the regime we have, not just in Washington, but in Canada and other places. But there is a role. The National Library of Medicine is a very good example. It's about a $250 million operation a year that provides services to the profession. And so and if we look at the area of health then, there is a huge role for information dissemination through the federal government. And I think that one argument I'm making is that that's going to be an easier case to make if there's public access. If everybody in the House or the Senate has some member of their family that has tapped into university research information and has found it valuable, that there's an easier case to make, not just for the NIH in the area of health, but in NEH and NSF and the other funding agencies. So I think there is a role for government. I think there's a greater role right now from the PBS model for the foundations. The Mellon Foundation has been the largest sponsor to date of innovation in this field. And one of my big interests in ATANA and Paul Gurman and Vanderbilt is he has a letter of invitation from the Mellon Foundation. And as a Canadian, we need to find these routes and means to get to these American foundations. So PBS did not start with government, with a dollar of government support. PBS was Carnegie, Ford, and I'm not totally convinced, I don't know the whole specter of the origins of PBS, but it was that kind of initiative. And I'm looking right now and have support from foundations in Canada to carry it out. There are sort of three phases of the project. One is the most expensive is the implementation and development. All right, and that will need, I think, foundation breakthrough innovative money. Then there's the sustainability of the system, which I'm throwing back on the shoulders of the university and the university library. And then there's the continual upgrading of the system. And I think that upgrading of the system will need to continue to have research funding, will need to be seen as a site of educational investment in terms of both the federal government and other research agencies. So that sense of how of the economy, and again, I don't have this worked out in great detail, as you can tell, but I'm never given more than 50 minutes to talk about it, so you know why should I bother? That the details of this, and it would just be foolish and naive for me to work out too many of the details, because they clearly have to be worked out both by discipline and by association and organization. It was here, and now we've got these two. That's a nice job. It's a nice looking journal, though. I must. And I, you know, with all due respect, want to consider that question of why editors aren't walking and what the advantages are. There's no question, let me deal with the basic one about the copy editing. I mean, the irony for me is that publishers don't do any of this stuff. They outsource it all. The copy editors are freelance. They don't print. The printing is sent out. They do, in-house. Okay. All right. But the system I'm proposing would have to allow for all of that. If I'm going to guarantee an improvement in the scholarly quality, I cannot give up on copy editing. I cannot give up on proofreading. I cannot give up on those quality aspects. So the system has, I believe, enough money. I mean, it's just a given that it does, because it's already paying for all of these things. And as editors, if anything, I think the service needs to be increased, because there are many editors who are donating their time without release or without support of their institutions. And so those elements of this economy need to be taken into account. The question then is, if we lay out the service, if we lay out the quality, if we address the prestige question, and again, the prestige question is going to change, and that is, we're going to say to people, you can no longer rely on the prestige of the journal. You're going to have to rely on the prestige of your article and of your name. I can see there's a challenge there, but I'm prepared to let that take a few years to work in. So what I want to do then is not ask you to walk. I want to build an alternative system that is so attractive that the contributors to your journal decide, if it's neither here nor there, I'd rather go this way because of the following features, whether it's the public engagement, and in an area like library high tech, which has a large professional reading, it may well be that public presence in terms of the profession and access, and that is, the electronic journals can guarantee a much larger access rate than print journals. The average academic print journal, not the average, but that whole group of print journals that exists at the 500 to 600 level circulation, do you know those? There's a very large group of journals at that level, and electronically they can very easily exceed that level of dissemination without interlibrary loan or other kinds of aspects. So it's not a matter of asking or persuading editors, well, I think it is in a certain degree. Of walking, it is a matter of a period of experimentation and a period of demonstration of value for alternative systems. And I think DLib is a very good example in terms of library high tech. I mean, you get a very nice looking, I know library high tech, a very nice looking journal, but DLib is providing a whole range of services that go beyond the typical journal services. It has the experimental sites itself, it has the archive, the complete archiving from the moment you subscribe. And I think those things need to be considered as aspects that add to the scholarly quality. Because what's interesting for me is the notion of the journal is going to change. What's interesting for me is that what's happening, for example, in the Near East Ancient Studies, I just smile every time I say it because you wouldn't think these were the most innovative people. I call them deadseascrolls.com. What they want to do is they want to get the archaeological field sites, the huge archival repository of inscription of photographs and museum pieces, and the scholarly publishing integrated. And that, to me, creates a very different kind of attitude than just scholarly journals. That is, you can tap into archaeological digs the day they happen. They are publishing data from the day they dig up the new pieces of the arc. They consider me to be somewhat of an outsider in terms of my sense of things. But you can also then look at archival resources that are only available, or that have previously only been available at the Louvre or at the University of Southern California, which has the largest digital archive resource in this area. So it's a different attitude towards the very object of scholarship itself and the very level of engagement. And I think that's very exciting for students in terms of education. That is one of the concerns of a library needs to be the level of intellectual engagement of students and their ability to engage with primary sources, original documents, with original research. All of those things are in the offing. So it is a matter of getting good copy editing, and it is a matter of seeing a changing object of research. It was here and here.
Get back to the federal government funding. Just, if you look at funding of research, medical research, sure, I'm sure, and most of it, just a large chunk of the money that comes from funding research comes from the federal government. It seems like a natural thing. I mean, why do this research?
Yeah, 250. Well, the accountability aspect is so critical in that. That is that the public has paid for this. We give it away to the publishers. I mean, to me, it's a very easy case to make, but it hasn't persuaded people totally to this point. But I mean, I think the federal involvement I probably underestimated in terms of the fact they paid for the research in the first instance.
It's not right now, but they paid for it on the back end, too. I mean, for every United States, it's usually 40% to 50% of the U.S. funds to the universities for building infrastructure. Well, some of that money ends up for paying for the buildings, so it ends up paying back to the public. They get that on both sides.
And the one factor that I think is critical in this is that just to increase that public presence then is part of the argument for the increasing support of institutions like this. It was here, that's right. Yeah. No. The editor is present. There is no publication without an editor, but the editor doesn't need to exist at the place where the article is published. So, in other words, you would submit your article to your university library, and it would immediately queue up with editors at whatever institution the editor is at. Because I agree with you, there can be no publication without editorial oversight. And still, yeah, I all of that needs to be concluded. It's a small aspect, and that is, when Paul talks about the circle of gifts, he's talking about each institution taking on responsibility for a given area, article, or sorry, given publication, research area, resource like an archive. My concern, and I think that's fine. My idea was just that instead of doing that, we'd say, all of the resources at MSU, the publications, the archives, would be housed, would be situated here, but that would be invisible to the editors. And an editor would still say in the humanities, we're doing an exciting new issue on this topic. If you want to submit an article, just use these tags. And you would submit the article, And in the submission process, it would exist both at the university, but it would be obviously in the editor's desktop as well. It's the library is sponsoring the publication to a certain degree because it's maintaining the system as a distributed database system. It's not coming between. It is the site of, if you wish, it's where the copy resides. And so it's not an important point to me. The copy can reside in a national library. The copy can reside, as it were, electronically can reside in the library. The copy can reside in the editor's university. So the circle of gifts versus the knowledge exchange is not a critical factor for me. But it doesn't come between. No, when you submit an article, it has to reside on a computer somewhere. And that computer somewhere can exist virtually anywhere. And so the idea I had was that it could exist, the libraries could host these resources, and they could be hosted by professional associations, which don't have the resources to host these things. They could be hosted by the editors. So in some ways, the circle of gifts is equivalent to the knowledge exchange. Yes, sir.
What about copyright implications?
The copyright implications, and there are interesting developments around this. The copyright implication, essentially, at its barest bones, is that the university, or at least the scholar, retains the copyright. The scholar turns over the copyright to the degree that the scholar says, I retain the copyright for any commercial republication, any commercial repurposing of this. I give the system, whatever the system is going to be called, circle of gifts, knowledge exchange, I give the system a right to have open public access as long as my intellectual rights are protected. That is, there's no repackaging of it, no tampering with it, it's authenticated. And those two aspects, one, no commercial repurposing without authorization, and the other is free open access within the given, whatever the names of the system is. At the back? Yes. Inter pares, yeah. And she's referring to the Inter Pares project that UBC is heading, which is an international group concerned with the archiving, largely of diplomatic materials, but of the most serious kind of archiving that can go on, in the sense of preservation of the papal encyclicals and those sorts of things. But there needs to be a standard. And one of my concerns with ARL and with this whole project is we cannot keep creating these individually proprietary standards. That what's interesting about the Inter Pares group is it's working with Adobe and with other document management software companies to establish new standards for not only archiving, but authentication and verification of documents, which I think is a critical issue in the intellectual integrity of people's work. I think it's a critical issue in terms of being able to do a historical analysis of the history of ideas and all of those different aspects. So my concern with building a larger system is just that one. That is, digital preservation is an issue. I think it is conquerable at the 100-year level, by all means. But I think it is foolish for us to think about it, and incredibly expensive for us to think about it in anything less than a global basis. And whereas Inter Pares, this group that is international, if not globally, in its conceptions, is developing standards. What interests me is how those standards are going to be implemented and how those standards don't apply simply in the way I foresee this project developing is it will pick up pieces. The project itself will not develop the standards. It will say Inter Pares, although it's working in diplomatic archiving, has developed a very strong set of standards that we will now adopt as part of our standards for archiving. Similarly, Open Archives is developing a standard for database access, and we will adopt those standards. So each of these issues, and I think the archiving one is another concern. It's the indexing one, I think, is even more, because I'm not historically conscious enough, but the indexing and the archiving are two of the critical issues. And again, I think we need to see ways of building on existing resources and speaking to associations like ARL around how we can begin to use those as standards. And what strikes me as odd that the web is so much about anarchy, so much about the freedom of this anarchistic romantic notion on the one hand, and I keep running into the silly answer that the answer is standards at every point. And it kind of rubs against me the wrong way, because I just want to run free, you know, through the cyber fields of space. But when you look at the telegraph, I mean, it's also like the historical aspects. The telegraph was the first international standard system, and what a difference it made when people just began to develop and accept these kinds of standards, and what a simple solution it poses. Are we over or not? But we exhausted the questioning possibilities. There is, John did mention that you'd be willing to. Oh, you've already done it. Very efficient. Okay, so for $8.95, there's a video of today's performance. No, this is totally at MSU's, a circle of gifts. If we could just all join hands at this point, and we could form the circle of gifts that we're going to give. There's a website. There's an extended argument for this proposal on the website, and I don't think. Let me just see that for a second. Oh, here it is. There's also a project site for the Public Knowledge Project. The project site for the Public Knowledge Project is on, the URL is on this. If you just click on it twice with your thumbnail, you can go to it. Has my demonstration projects with the Vancouver Sun, with the Ministry of Education, and with we have another one called policy.ca, a Canadian policy site based on policy.com, or at least stolen some of the ideas. And if you stay tuned to that, we're going to continue to be putting up a whole series of prototypes and projects. If anyone of you, and I can use this venue to do that, has a project that you're thinking about or run into people that are thinking about a project, I do have the resources to play this kind of consulting role. What I'm doing with Aitana, with the Near Eastern, is working with them, although I have so little expertise, I don't have any expertise, so little knowledge of the area. They just, you know, this whole ARC thing. You're going to find the ARC now? No, they just don't like that example. I'm looking for projects in which we can play a collaborative role, because this will only work if we develop a whole range of prototypes, and it will only work if other people develop them besides one silly individual like me, that it needs to have this kind of fertilization, needs to have this kind of experimentation. So I'm really trying to create that kind of ferment so that the system alternatives can begin to appear, and we can create such a persuasive and convincing case that even library high tech will consider an alternative form. Okay, thank you very much.